our program with our featured speaker for our luncheon session. And one of the things that the committee wanted to do is take a look. You know, we've looked at new products, we've looked at new opportunities, and what we want to do now is take a look at new developments in the marketplace. And we have the great opportunity to have with us today Chris Bates, who is the editor and publisher at Ball Publishing. Many of you probably know him from many trade shows, but also from his work doing Growers Talk newsletter, and he does five now in different segments of the market. So Chris is on the air weekly, daily, getting all the information from various segments of the market, and we said, perfect guy to invite and say, what's going on out there today? So, Chris Bates.
Thank you, Brian.
I'm on the air right now, as a matter of fact. This whole thing's live. I've got a camera embedded in my forehead, and, which about you could. Yeah, well, it's embedded back here. It's called an iPhone. But we'll get into the whole social media thing later. This was an interesting talk. Bob invited me to speak, and I thought, the Soil and Mulch Council, this will be different. This will be a little different than my usual growers or retailers, but I enjoy a challenge. And I started with a blank slate of piece of paper, and then started jotting down a few notes about what I know about what's going on in the lawn and garden industry, some demographic stuff. I listened to Bob Dolleboy from ANLA give a really interesting talk on that included a little bit of the history of our industry, of the gardening industry. I thought, I'd never heard anybody put it that way before, so I worked a little bit of that in here. By the time I was done, I had about 2 hours worth of talk, so sit back. This is going to be a long afternoon. No, I edited it down, because that's what I do. I'm an editor, so we're gonna kind of bang through this kind of quickly. Going to cover just a lot of different things about the industry, a little bit of history, some demographics, because that's really important to think about. Who are the new consumers out there, or the coming consumers? So I'm going to spend a bit of time there. Talk about some trends and some opportunities, a few warnings, and we'll just see where it goes. So if along the way you've got any questions, pop up a hand and I'll completely ignore you. But anyway, a brief history of our world as we know it. Now, before World War, how many of you were here before World War II besides Bob? All right. Okay. Nobody wants to admit. Lovely young woman. This is what you were missing out on back then. She's a looker. But gardening was really kind of a hobby for the wealthy. People didn't do a lot of ornamental gardening around the house like we do now. They did things that were a bit more practical, you know, like we have to eat, so we'll do some vegetable gardening. For the regular folks like us, and maybe we're actually kind of coming back full circle there, so that's something to think about. But and then after World War II, the GI Bill, there was money out there, and a fellow named Abraham Levitt and his sons created a place that I think you've all heard of, Levittown, which was one of the first suburban housing developments, and it looked kind of like that. And that looks like if you're out in Chicago, west of Chicago, you're driving west and you think you've just about hit Iowa, there's cornfields, and then you come over a rise and you see that scene still today, except the houses are a lot different. Back then, you know, this was the typical little tract house that some of you may remember, maybe your parents had as a first starter home. But what was unique about this is when Mr. Levitt designed these houses, they were kind of like a little mini estate. There was actually a front yard and a backyard and a couple of side yards, and you see some little tiny landscaping plants in there. So this was something new. People actually had their own little piece of America they could kind of garden on. And then the families got bigger, and so did the houses. Anybody recognize that house? There you go. All right, so now we're in my generation here. The boomers started, you know, were being born, and they were with mom and dad, were moving into houses like this. And then it got bigger and bigger. The boomers my generation started buying their own homes, and of course they've got to be bigger than what the parents had, what the Brady Bunch had. So we had the McMansions and the faux chateaus. And that's pretty hideous there, you got to admit. Not to mention the fellow with the hair. But and then garden centers kind of followed the same path, which is interesting. You know, I can look back to Grower Talks from 1937. That's when my magazine started. And if you look in those early issues, you don't see anything about garden centers. It's all florists. back then. And the florist sold cut flowers. They might have sold a few potted plants. If they did anything at all with petunias or other things that we now call bedding plants, they were direct sown and then pulled apart and wrapped in newspaper and, you know, mostly put in pots or flower beds. But, you know, in a garden center, this is even circa 1960, so this is a little newer. Now we've got, you know, mega chains and some massive, big, beautiful independent retailers. Really the same path between 1950 and 2000 that kind of the houses and the gardens followed. So what's that mean? Well, the role of landscaping back then, back in Levittown, was really for ornamentation, to dress up this cool little house that you now have, and for differentiation, because every house was the same. So a way you could make your garden a little bit, your house a little different, was to plant a little bit different garden. And, you know, and we even call it ornamental horticulture. That's what my minor is in. My wife's got a degree in ornamental horticulture. I never really thought about that. But now, today, it's changing. And really the role of landscaping today is more, or as it's increasingly, for lifestyle. Anybody here have garden rooms? Everybody. Anybody have a garden room? Anybody got more than one garden? Got an old garden house out in your backyard? That's the hot trend, especially on the TV shows. And also function and purpose. And we'll talk about that. So, you know, who doesn't want, if you don't have one of these, who doesn't want one? Raise your hand. You're nuts if you don't. We all want that. That's a lot different than the lawn chairs I sat in my parents' house, you know, with the webbing that pinched the back of your leg and pulled the hairs out of your thighs and things like that. This is a little bit different, right? But how about function? Rain, this is much more important. Rainwater conservation, runoff control. A purpose. There's some reason to have that landscape. It's not just pretty. Privacy, certainly. As those houses got bigger, in many cases the lots did not get bigger. We just packed more houses into a smaller area, and now you're 10 feet away from your neighbor's bathroom window, right? So we need more functional privacy landscaping. Edibles is certainly making inroads to where more and more people want a vegetable garden, and also make it ornamental as well. And then this is an interesting, this is from Fern Creek Design. I pulled this offline. I'm giving them full credit because they've got a watermark up in there. But look, a diverse backyard ecosystem with a moist meadow community and an alpine community and compost bins, you know, and all of this stuff. And this is the kind of thing that today's consumers are thinking about when they're thinking about their landscape. Maybe they're not thinking about it, but if it's brought to their attention, they'd be saying, yeah, this is what I need to be doing, especially the younger generation that we're going to start talking about here. So that's just sort of a little change, as I said. So it's really more about lifestyle combined with purpose instead of just ornamental horticulture. Now, how about the demographics of the folks out there today? Most of us in here are boomers or Gen X, I would guess. And so we can identify with this. 77 million baby boomers born between 46 and 64. Now, what's really interesting is I was pulling these numbers. I kind of know them in my head. Yeah, there's 70 million some odd baby boomers, and they were born in this time range. But if you Google it, you'll find almost as many different numbers and date ranges as there are sources of the information. And I thought, boy, that's really weird. But I've got a solution to that in a second. So if maybe you've heard that it's, you know, 46 to 60, and then there's these Joneses that were from 60 to 68, and blah blah blah, forget about that stuff. I'll show you. But anyway, you know, they're epitomized by who are these guys? There you go. All right. Gen X, 49 million of them. Notice that's a smaller number. We went from 77 million down to 49 million born between 65 and 79. Who can identify these guys? There's not a single Gen Xer in here.
Guns N' Roses?
No, there's only three of them here. Nirvana. There you go. Voice of the Gen, and I conferred with some Gen Xers about, okay, who should I put in here? Nirvana, they agreed, because Kurt Cobain killed himself, John Lennon's dead, so there's some, you know, it's angst. All right, how about Gen Y? Well, there really is no music to the Gen Y. All I have a picture of Lady Gaga in here, but they said, no, not her. Well, how about some, no. And I found this, and so I solved the problem. 76 million of them born between 1980 and 2000. But in spite of this, they're pretty important to us, and I'm going to show you why right now. I showed you that there are fewer Gen Xers than baby boomers. And what that has done is led to a big dip in today's consumption population. I don't care if we're talking about consuming soil, mulch, garden plants, iPads, it doesn't matter. There are fewer of them out there, and I'll show you why. This I got from my friend Dr. Charlie Hall down at TAMU, who's an expert on demographics and all things economic. But I borrowed this from him because this is a very important chart. This is births per year from 1909, way at the far left end, to 2011. And what you can see is right here a dip between these two yellow lines here. Now, the peak right up here at the top, that's 1960. That's when I was born. It was a popular year for births. Anybody else born in 1960 in here? Three of 1960, go 1960. I don't know, that's ridiculous to say. There you go. Okay, now the dip. We go down to the bottom of the dip there, 1975. Anybody born in 1975 in here? See, because there's so few of them. No, 1975, sir, not 05. See, there's so few of them. But where that's important is, if we look at this, also nice chart that Charlie loaned me, this shows kind of the age at which people do certain things. And if you look at starter homes, it's age 33, trade-up homes, age 44, and peak spending, age 48. Well, the baby boom, the Gen X generation, right there, that range of about 12 to 14 years is right now at that 33 to 46 age area, or just approaching that, where they're reaching into their peak housing and then spending years, and there's a whole lot less of them doing that than there were when they were baby boomers. So part of the economic situation you're seeing in the U.S. isn't to blame on the economy or the housing bubble or Obama or Bush or anything else like that. It's simply fewer people of a particular age that would be buying stuff, including our stuff. So that's, you know, it's kind of the reality of things. The nice thing is, look at as the chart goes upwards, though. Now we're getting into Gen Y. And Gen Y, as I pointed out, I think there said there were 79 million of them. There's as many or more Gen Y consumers coming along as there were baby boomers. So we basically have to ride out this little demographic population slump, and there are going to be a whole lot more people to sell to. But who are those people? This is where it gets really important for you guys, because yes, the boomers are going to continue to spend, but I'll tell you what, I mean, I bought 15 yards of mulch for my garden last year, and I buy that every 2 years or so you guys like me, you know, but am I going to have the energy to do that every year? At some point, I'm going to be like, I'm too old and tired for this, you know, I'm done. You got to hope some younger person is coming along to take over my mulch consumption. Now, Charlie Hall, again, I leaned on him for all things demographic and statistical. He says that Gen Y is arguably the brightest, most aspirational, this is in spite of the pant thing, by the way, the most aspirational, best educated, and the greenest generation to date. So don't underestimate them. There's some smart kids out there. You know, everybody moans about the coming generations. Hey, when we were young, our parents and grandparents thought we were going to be failures. And look at us. Come on. We're at the Sheraton right now, you know? So there's hope for these guys, in other words. However, you know, their incomes are down. We see this. It's all over the news right now, right? Incomes are down. More than 30% are unemployed straight out of college. And look at these college debts. I mean, I had a little bit of college debt. I think it was $5,000 or $10,000 or something when I came out in 1983. I can't fathom some of the debts that some of these kids have taken on, and in some cases for a fine arts degree or something like that. It's one thing going to med school, but big school debts, that's going to impact things. You know, they'll move into the housing market, but what can they afford? I mean, tent cities. And maybe that's their future. I don't know, the way how the housing market is. They aspire to home ownership. Hey, we all do. But they're going to be more cautious because they saw the housing bust. Maybe they saw their parents lose a home or family members or friends. So, you know, in some ways, I think this generation could wind up more like the silent generation, my dad's generation that came up through the Depression, where they're going to be a little bit more cautious about money. You know, they're going to be a little more spendthrift. But that also means that, you know, maybe they're not going to be buying houses as soon as we would like or as soon as previous generations did. And if they're not in houses, they're not doing the kind of gardening and landscaping we need for them to be buying our products, right? And again, according to Charlie, and I'm sure he gets this information from even more expert folks than he is, a lot of them are going to want to live not out in the country on a, you know, a 1 acre lot like I want, but in urban areas. Walk about suburban town centers, as they're called in some places, where you get a nice little two bedroom, two bath condo, and you walk down to, you know, food, drink, dining, and theater and everything, and the only gardening that goes on is maybe a little bit of window box action or some community planters out there, but not the kind of landscape that parents and grandparents did in Levittown or at the Brady Bunch's house. So that's important to know. And because of a lot of these factors, they may be renting for a long time. And renters don't tend to buy much soil and mulch or much of my stuff either, at least not on a large scale. So that's important to think about. And there are some solutions. Last bit of demographic information is immigrant population, which we tend not to think about unless we're talking about illegal immigration and whether we ship them back or put them to work or, you know, those kind of issues that I won't go into. But there are 40 million immigrants in America right now. It's 13% of households, and even more important to all of us is immigrants arriving between now and 2050 are going to drive 82% of the population growth in America. Now, I think that's good news for us because a lot of immigrants, depending upon their culture, do have more of an agrarian or gardening culture, a culinary culture that lends itself to food and herbs, vegetables, etc., which is really good for us because I think that can, you know, that certainly those are our customers. I've seen that in my wife worked for a while in a grocery store in Chicagoland called Caputo's, which was Italian-owned, very ethnic, multicultural, people from all over the world shopping in there. And the kinds of stuff that she could move through that garden center was just mind-blowing compared to what she would see move through a regular Western store, whatever you want to kind of call it. So that's good news for us. And these people may be doing the kind of gardening that we need to help keep us doing our jobs as we have been. And that's important to talk about. All right, so what does all this mean to you? Let's get into some nuts and bolts here. All right, we have seen a downsizing of gardens in America. People are not planting the South 40. They're not doing quarter-acre vegetable gardens, even if they are vegetable gardening, like the parents or grandparents did. Container gardening is up. Small, if there are flower beds, it's small ones. It's just a patch around the mailbox or something like that. This is going to continue with this next generation. We aren't going to see any kind of a reversal to, you know, big, big beds that require lots and lots of mulch. It's going to stay small, so we're going to have to deal with that reality. This is a very important part. Packaging. When convenience in general, let me start there. Convenience is going to be critical for a lot of reasons. It's going to be critical for the older population who can't schlep a 50-pound sack of something anymore, but they still want to do some of the gardening they did when they were 30 years old. So you can't keep selling them the same big, heavy, possibly wet and dirty product that maybe you got away with 10 or 20 years ago. This is a product I actually saw in a store recently. You know, I like wine as much as the next guy, but let's just say I'm not dropping to the convenience store and picking up wine already in a glass, because that implies you need it like while I'm on the sidewalk out front. I don't even have time to get home with this. You know, I mean, there are times when I feel that way, but that's what the brown paper bag is for, right? So, come on, people, get with it here. But apparently, some smart guy said, you know what, there are probably consumers who don't have wine glasses. They're going out for a quick little thing. They don't even want to buy a full bottle because that's too much, you know. So this is perfect, and they're probably selling. And, you know, it's a nice-looking little package there. So that's to give you the idea about convenience, about sizing things for customers' needs today. I'm gonna try to emphasize that at every point along the way because it's one of the most important messages I feel like that I came up with for you guys. This is a cool one. You know, the Chinese takeout box hasn't changed in, you know, forever. I mean, it was probably the Ming Dynasty, you know, 2,000 years ago, I think, is when they came up with the cardboard thing. And I saw this one online, and I said, that's really cool, you know, with the chopsticks through the top. A new way to package Chinese food. If you had to come up with a new way to package Chinese food that was better than what the Chinese came up with, you never would, you know. But look at that, it's beautiful. It may actually be Japanese, though, so... but anyway, you know, and some fun. I just, you know, that's you want to buy something just to carry that bag home. You know? That's pretty cool.
stuff.
So now, you know, let's, but you know, we have some fun there and think outside the box, but how does it relate to our industry? I go to Horty Fair almost every year. I used to go every year. It's really downsized now. In fact, it's going on as we speak in Amsterdam. But you go to some of the European shows, you see that convenience is already important and being addressed over there. Because if you, how many of you have been to Europe, especially to the Netherlands? All right, so if you've been around, you pull into a gas station to buy some gas, you know, and you spend a couple thousand euros to buy a tank of gas. But you always notice there are plants there to buy, and they always look really nice. And if you look more closely, you'll find out they almost always have some kind of a handle associated with them so you can pick it up. It's very convenient. I mean, these beautiful bromeliads, well, not only that, there's another reason I'm showing you this picture. They've got a handle at the top, so you could be selling these in any kind of a retail outlet, and a lady can just grab it and take it, and it's a, you know, beautiful gift item. But look at something else here. There's a pot of bromeliad right there. But underneath, in the glass, tall, narrow glass vase, there's an air pocket underneath. And they use that, this packager, to package some other kinds of gift items. I think they had some beach-type items, sunglasses, and a suntan lotion, and another one had a little spa package, which was like a little loofah and a brush and a face cloth or some soap or something like that. So this is creating two gifts in one. Now, some guy grew this bromeliad for about a euro and a half, 4 million of them a year, blows them out of the greenhouse. He's not making this, but somebody is buying that bromeliad, buying the glass vase, buying the spa stuff, putting it all together and creating something that went from a buck and a half or a euro and a half bromeliad to probably a 20 euros gift idea. These are the kinds of things that you guys need to be thinking about. How else can I work with my raw material, my commodity product in all too many cases, to add value? Who could I be working with to do that? I mean, we've already heard our last young speaker give us maybe some good ideas about that. I thought that was pretty cool. More handle packages, convenience, more convenience in the vegetable trend idea. There's some convenience. Here's another area. This came to me fairly recently. Check this slide. There you go. There's a lot of this being done now. A lot of consumers want a vegetable garden. They don't want to dig up a spot in their backyard if they have a backyard to dig up. They may just have a patio area, but a raised bed, very convenient. Well, and I've seen some raised bed kits at garden centers. They're usually kind of cheesy for what I would want, maybe plastic or something. I could go to Home Depot and buy the lumber for this if I was really handy, but then I also need something to put in it, you know, the dirt, you know, for lack of a better term, because I'm a gardener. I'm a new gardener, so I don't even know what you call it. I need the dirt that goes in it. I don't know how much I need. And then I'm going to need plants, and I think I need fertilizer. Why hasn't anybody put together a kit with this that has everything? And the idea came after I mentioned Bob Dollarboy from ANLA. He was telling me about his experience at the Container Store. Anybody shop at the Container Store? Some people love the Container Store. I've been there with my wife. I don't love it because she spends too much money there. But Bob Dollarboy designed a closet. He went on his computer at home to the Container Store, and they have this Alpha Design Center. And all you do is you plug in some basic answers to questions. It'll ask you a question like, is this for a man or a woman? How big is the closet? Is it a walk-in or a reach-in closet? What kind of doors does it have? And how wide and how deep? You just put these easy numbers in, and up pops a potential configuration. Hey, I like that. That would work great for my closet. You save it under your name, and then you go to the store, and they can call it up in their computer system. Oh, here's what you designed. Is it all set? And they look at it. They ask a few more questions, make sure it's exactly what you want. And then they say, we'll take care of it. And in a few minutes, there is a shopping cart loaded with everything you need, right down to the molly bolts, every single detail. You don't have to make an extra trip to Ace Hardware for the hangers or what have you. It's all right there, ready to go. And you've got sort of a commercial grade, very cool looking system. And he asked me the question, why isn't somebody doing that in our industry? Or how could we? Because I heard once from an editor at Better Homes and Gardens that probably 80% of the people who come into a garden center on any given day are trying to solve one of about a dozen problems, maybe even fewer than that. They've got a mailbox they want to plant, a front door they want to plant. They have a property line they want to divide. They have a back corner they want to do. They want to maybe put a bird bath in and a few bird attracting plants. Very simple, basic problems that could easily be, I think, addressed by something like this. So just to give you an idea of the ways that our industry can be adding convenience to what we do. Instead of walking to a garden center, there's all this various raw material everywhere, and you have to somehow figure out how much of all of it do I need, how do I get it all home. And in the case of this, if you want lumber, you have to go over to Home Depot for that, because we don't actually sell lumber. We have this kit, but it's only one size, blah, blah, blah. So there's that. Now, how about something else here? Another trend that I think is good for us is the authenticity trend. How many of you have granite or something similar in your kitchens now? Hold up your hands. Hold them up way high. Now, here's what's funny. You go back 100 years and you probably found soapstone or granite or some other natural material in the kitchen. And then in the 70s or in the 60s, they came up with this really cool stuff called formica. How many of you had formica in your kitchen at one time or another? Every hand goes up. Okay, now you got rid of the modern plastic stuff and you've gone back 100 years in time to the granite. Why is that? Because it looks cool, it's authentic. I mean, we all aspire to that. Well, that's just I don't know why it is, but we all like it, you know? Taking an old house and restoring it is much cooler than popping up something that looks like the Jetsons would live in it. You know, nobody lives in a Jetsons house unless they're a nut, right? You know, wear aluminum foil hats and stuff like that. So this is good for us because our product, the vast, vast majority of it, is a natural product. So we already have an advantage. It's authentic. It's from the ground. It's from trees, etc. And I've seen some trends in our industry along those lines. This is from Horti Fair. This is a packaging example using a burlap sack to wrap. I think these were cut flowers. So burlap, very natural. In fact, these were recycled bags from coffee or something like that. So that's very cool. You see the printing on it. The label is a disc of wood with a, you know, rubber stamped pure label on the front and a little bit of information on the back and a bit of, you know, natural looking string tying it all together. This is very cool. This is what consumers respond to, this kind of packaging. And I think our product lends itself to that sort of messaging as opposed to a very artificial plastic formica kind of a messaging. Authenticity is also kind of, where did it come from? Who made this? And I think we all like that. We all like to know where our products came from. You have a chance to buy something from the guy who made it versus from just some big distributor. You know, all things being equal, you want to know who made that. And there's, in fact, there's value in that. This was a plant company that was selling some tropical plants, very simple things that might cost a couple of euros, you know, from the grower, and 8 or 10 euros in a store. But there's a picture tag with the guy who grows these, or at least one of the guys who grows them in this case, I think it's in Africa, but it could be in Central America or anywhere around the world. So I think it shows the authenticity, the origin, the point of origin of it. So I think that's very important. Now this is, going green is both one of your biggest opportunities and it's one of your biggest challenges. Now I can tell you that right now, peat has a bad rap. Am I wrong? I mean, people who don't even garden somehow have heard that peat is a bad thing. Well, I'm going, oh, I don't want that peat moss. That's stripping the landscape. It's causing global warming. It's there's people dying. There's spiders that don't have a habitat. And who knows what they've heard. But even if they're not gardeners, that word has gotten out to them. So it's... And that can really carry over to anything that's in a bag at a garden center. Because consumers don't know what peat moss is. They just know that it's, you know, for some reason it's not good. And the mainstream media loves picking up those kinds of stories. They hate the good stories. So that makes your task even harder when it's messaging your product. And what are, maybe, you know, in the case of some of the peat suppliers in Canada and elsewhere, I know there's a ton of work being done to restore bogs, to, you know, once the top layer is harvested, to bring the top back so that it is a habitat again. And, you know, the percentage of peat bogs versus habitat is infinitesimal, but that's not the message that's getting out there. So there needs to be positive messages going out. And it needs to be not as a reaction to bad publicity. This is what's happened in the cut flower industry, where every Mother's Day or Valentine's Day, somebody does a story on the poisonous cut flowers that you're giving mom, and how there are mothers somewhere in Central America being poisoned, and their baby, you know, unborn babies being poisoned by, you know, fungicides, just so your mom can have a nice rose. Well, at one point in time, unfortunately, that was probably more true than false. But those companies have cleaned up their acts considerably, and Central American, South American, Kenya growers are now some of the cleanest in the world, believe it or not. But that message isn't going to get out there. Nobody's going to tell you that message. It's still going to be the poison message. So when it comes to getting out positive news, a positive message about your products, where they come from, how sustainable they are, you're going to have to be on top of that now, not just doing it as a reaction to some bad press that is going to come. But because of a lot of things we've already talked about Gen Y being the greenest generation, yeah, you know, we baby boomers, we cleaned up the air and the water in 1970 after that Indian paddle through that swamp, that terrible looking river. We did a good job, but this next generation is going to do even more than that. They're going to be more conscientious about sustainable products, natural, organic. It's going to be on top of their mind every time they visit a garden center or have something done in their landscape. So it's a great opportunity to provide that kind of messaging, provided it's authentic messaging. There's great opportunities there. Now, here's another issue that we're facing. And I think we all know this. We are a maturing industry. I was a grower from about 1983 to 92. I had a greenhouse, and it didn't matter what I put in the greenhouse, I could sell it. I had to just get an unlisted phone number. The business was so easy back then, believe it or not. And now, you know, I got out of the business because somewhere in that curve, there was shakeout happening. It starts at birth, growth, then shakeout, shook me out. And we've seen the mergers, the acquisitions, the people going out, both in your field, over on the greenhouse side, garden center side. It's all happening. We're at the mature point right now. And what does that mean? Well, if you're in a mature industry, and this applies to every industry there is, not just us, you've got two choices. You can either differentiate, a better product that you can charge more for, a different product, a unique product, something that nobody else has, or you can be the low-cost producer, be more efficient than the next guy. But you really only have those two choices. You can't really dabble in both fields, and not everybody's going to be the low-cost producer. You might think you are, and maybe you are, but that means the other guy who thinks he is isn't. So you've got to decide, which one of those two am I going to be? There's really no middle ground. Now we're going to talk about social media. Bob asked me to bring this one up to find out, okay, is there any opportunities for social media for you guys? And that's maybe the toughest question I had to try to answer here. And I'm not sure if I've got a satisfactory answer or not, but we're going to try. What I'm going to do first is I'm going to define social media a little bit, because that's really the most confusing thing for people. What the heck is it? They've all seen this. They wish they'd invented it, right? You know? But how to get rich quick. But what is social media? Well, first off, social media takes place. And actually, do I want to talk about that way? All right, let's start here first. I think this makes more sense. No, we'll start back here. All right, social media really has two definitions. It's what happens between friends and family using Facebook or all these other tools. And then there's the second aspect of it, which is the sort of business-to-consumer or business-to-business social media. That's what I'm involved in. I send out an email called Acres Online. Anybody get that here, Acres Online? A couple of you. Subscribe. It's pretty interesting. I do say so myself. But it goes to about 20,000 people around the world. And it's just stuff that I'm doing and seeing and taking note of, press releases, gossip, whatever. And I shoot it out via email, comes right into your inbox. And I've been doing it now for 10 years before social media was even a term. And it's been pretty popular. That's B2B social media. What most of you probably are already involved in is family and friends social media. How many of you have Facebook pages that you use regularly to keep in touch with your kids, your friends, brothers, sisters, whoever? A good chunk of you. How many of you are not participating in social media in any way, as far as you know? Raise your hand. All right, how many of you are happy to stay that way forever? Keep your hand up. All right, you guys are in trouble. So you need to hire a young person. Hire a Gen Y person, first off. Or at least if you've got one, put them in charge of this, because this is kind of important. All right, so anyway, that's said. Now, here's where I'm going to actually make you kind of like social media. Because for that, remember we were showing you the history from 1950, or from World War II on, to say 2000, we saw how much the housing business, houses changed, landscaping changed, garden centers changed. One thing that didn't change was how businesses communicate with consumers. That whole time period, you had mass media. You had newspapers, you had radio, then television came in, but those others didn't go away. Magazines have always been around, and direct mail. You have basically those five methods of communicating with your customers, and that stayed consistent. You never had to think about a new means of communication. You just needed a budget. If you wanted to put a newspaper, magazine ad, whatever, you had to budget big for it. Then came the internet, computers, iPhones, little digital video cameras, all this technological stuff that suddenly made every one of us a potential mass media outlet. You don't have to wait for a TV station to run an ad for you. You can make a YouTube video and email it directly out to all your customers and make sure they see it, which they probably wouldn't do if you put it on TV. Every one of you in your pocket or your computer has a newspaper, a radio station, a magazine, a TV station, all that stuff, direct mail, except it's called email now. That's a lot of power. That is a ton of power that you have. So if you look at it that way, and if you're not taking advantage of it, then you can really think that, maybe I'm missing the boat here. Now, because what you really have to think is all these things that we've talked about, Facebook, Twitter, what the heck's that? YouTube, Pinterest. I'm not interested in Pinterest. That's my wife. All these things, they're just tools. You know? Now, what's funny to me is how excited these tools have gotten, have made us. Because a fax machine, I think, was sort of like one of the first social media tools, or could have been. But nobody got excited when they got their first fax machine. Nobody said, ooh, let's fax everybody we know. Let's hire a guy in charge of faxing. We didn't do that. Maybe we should. I don't know. We missed the whole fax boat, I think. I don't know. Or maybe the fax was the 8-track of the social media world. It just went away. But those, they're just tools. They're just simply tools. And so that you shouldn't be scared. Nobody in this room should be afraid of tools by any means. Now, here's another important point about social media. Social media is a mindset. Now, those of you who raised your hand when you said, I'm not interested, I'm glad you're being honest with it, because you would be the world's worst social media people. I wouldn't want to read one of your blogs. It would probably be all about how much I hate social media. I tell all my friends on Facebook how I hate it. Actually, maybe that'd be a good one to do. I don't know. But so social media is not a task for your to-do list. You have to find somebody within your company. Might be you, might be one of your kids, might be a new young employee, who knows who. Maybe you even hire somebody who embraces it, who gets it, who loves it, who wants to do it, who wants to be online every day for a limited amount of time, because you can spend too much time doing it, sharing your stories. That's very important. If you're not into it, you'll be bad at it, and you won't do it nearly enough. This is another really important point, and this is where I kind of run into a little bit of a roadblock for you guys reaching your customers or the end consumer, but I think this is where the potential is. Social media is personal. I get a lot of stuff on Facebook and other places from companies, from a company sending me information from some generic person who wrote something saying, at such and such a business, we do so and so. And I think, well, that's really nice, but where's the president of the company? Where's the owner of the company? How come Bob isn't sending me an email saying, hey, I'm Bob, and I went in the office this morning, and I saw the greatest such and such and so and so? That would be more interesting. That's why my emails are successful. And as Bob said, we now do 5 weekly or twice monthly emails that go around the world. I think probably once a month we hit hundreds of thousands of readers. But every one of those emails is successful because it comes from a person, not from Ball Publishing or from Grower Talks or from Green Profit, but from Chris or Ellen or Jennifer or the other editors. And that's what makes it successful. So if you're going to do it, you've got to do it, or a person has to do it. It can't just come from so-and-so's mulch company. Nobody cares about it. So should you be using social media? Well, I think the answer is, and I've kind of summed it up, I think you should be, because Gen Y is using it. They're shopping there. They're using it to communicate. How you use it, how you find somebody within your business to be the voice of your business, or the face if it's a YouTube video, that's a challenge. What kind of message are you going to put out there? That's going to have to come from you. I can't tell you that. I can tell you, I went to YouTube either last night or this morning, and I looked on YouTube, I looked up peat moss harvest, just out of curiosity. And I found some videos. Most of them were from Europe, Finland or Russia or someplace, in the language, no English, poorly done, some with some heavy metal, like death metal background music, which was a little scary to me. But I mean, do it. Find out for yourself. One from Canada, I think, except there was no voiceover, and it was just really bad video from a distance of a harvester kind of driving around. Didn't tell me anything. One of you could make the first really good videos about what is peat moss, where does it come from, how sustainable are we? And you kind of own that marketplace. So there are opportunities out there. What a great segue. How do I do that? Opportunities. All right, we've already talked about this. The green, organic, sustainable thing. I know a lot of you are already doing this, but there's just going to be more and more of this. It's a lot of it, in fact, most of it isn't about the product. I know you can develop and already have developed really good products. But getting that message out to these consumers, from the packaging, from the verbiage you use, the name of the product, all these things are so critical. And you can't be thinking about what maybe attracted that first woman I showed you in the picture of the Victorian gardener or Mrs. Brady. You have to know these new customers and what they're thinking, what they're responding to. And that's another reason to be involved in social media. Something I should have mentioned, the beautiful thing about social media is it's two-way. When you used to advertise on a TV station or in a newspaper or wherever it might have been, you never got any feedback from those customers. You had a phone number at the bottom and how many people called. With social media, you can put information out, you can ask a question, your customers give you feedback. They love to do that. Sometimes, you know, negatively. But you learn that way, too. That's something you didn't get out of the old media. So that's a benefit for you guys to be involved in social media, to be listening as much as you're telling, probably more than you're telling. Telling, boy, that's twice so bad. Telling the story, making it personal, making it important. Today's consumers, all consumers, but especially the younger consumers, respond to stories, to authenticity, to where this product come from. Why is it good for me? How are you trying to help me and not rip me off, Mr. Big Corporation, because you know how negative all that stuff is. So it can't just be about dirt or mulch, because that's how consumers perceive that. So you got to tell the story. Convenience. I talked a lot about that. I think there's tremendous opportunities. You know, I was thinking today, why not buy a flower pot? You know, I want to plant something in that, but I need some soil for it. Oh, we've got little bags this big, and we've got some 40-pound sacks over there, all these different grades. Why doesn't that pot have dirt in it with like a plastic lid? I just peel it off, and it's ready to go. You know, somebody likes soup. Open it up. You don't have to like add the dry powdered soup to it. It's already in there, right? Just shove it in the microwave. Convenience is going to be very important for everybody, for the younger generation who expects it, for the older generation who needs it because of, you know, mobility restrictions or whatever. And the idea of co-branding something. Now, you guys may make potting soils or mulch or whatever it might be. You don't build whole kits for other stuff. If you could find the company that has those other products and you bring your products together, walk around garden centers and think about how is my stuff being used, either in this garden center or garden product, in the landscape, and who else is involved in making my product do what it's supposed to do. Your product is, you know, it's mulch, it's worthless if there's not a flower bed and flowers coming out of it. So maybe some partnership opportunities are there where everybody gets together and provides more of a finished package for the end consumer instead of just all the raw ingredients. Private labeling, I think, is another good opportunity, especially for big companies. Consumers love local retailers. They like to buy local, they like to know who they're buying from, and so they walk into a spot and they see they're in Bob's Garden Center and there's Bob's Best Mulch versus, you know, some big generic, you know, brand X. They might take that local stuff because there's opportunities there as well. They like that. And new technologies, which I think is a tremendous, when we talk about the gardening from a functional standpoint, and the drought we had this last summer, products that last longer, new colors, more exciting kinds of things, you know, and we've seen colored mulch, which some people can't stand, but I bet you could sell a ton of it to certain people, you know. We have the same problem in the garden world with painted plants or dyed plants, and most traditionalists hate them. You know, it's so unnatural. But I tell you what, you show a painted poinsettia or echeverria to consumers, and they go crazy over it. They buy it. So that's important. Application methods, because some of this stuff, if it's mulch, it's a pain to put out there. Maybe some better methods and benefits. And biochar, I had a chance to throw that in there. That was, you know, not even on my radar. But how are we gonna use what these guys are working on in our product? Now you can kind of look at it and go, I don't know, kind of scoff at it. But there's somebody in this room that the wheels are turning. They're thinking, yeah, we're gonna do some products here. This is a coming thing. So which end of the spectrum do you want to be on with that? And I'm gonna leave you with one last thing, because I thought, you know, are there any examples of a really sort of a commodity generic product that has done something to change its perceived value, uplift the cost and the benefits to the consumer, the price is higher, but the benefits are there. And I thought about this, because I bought this myself, all-purpose sand. Put down pavers in your backyard, you gotta put sand in the joints, right? So I bought this stuff for $2.78. And then a year later, the stuff is all washed away, and so I saw this stuff, Quikrete Power Lock, jointing sand. That's cool. Okay, so it's got a polymer in it that holds it in there, actually prevents weeds. That sounds pretty good. Oh, it's $13.10 for a sack of that stuff. And I bet there's not 2 bits worth of polymer in that whole sack. Well, maybe it's 4 bits. But the bottom line is, we just went from $2.78 to $13.10, still a 50-pound sack. And you now notice something? That's a pretty generic-looking bag. You got to make the bag a little bit fancier-looking, right? But it shows it can be done. If Quikrete can do it with sand, you guys can do it with soil and mulch. The end. I'm Chris Bates. Thanks for listening.
Thank you, Chris. We've got just a few minutes. Anybody have any questions? Bill.
Chris. I don't know. I fell asleep during that part of chemistry.
You're talking about these consumers, and we've got a division between, say, big box stores, materials sold there, and independent garden centers. Where are these guys going? Are they going to the Home Depot and the Lowe's?
I think they're going everywhere. In fact, younger, less experienced, if we're talking about gardening, they're going to the big box stores because they can go there anonymously. They know they're going to find it's convenient. They might be there already because they love painting and doing some of these little fix-up things that they're seeing on TV. So it's very easy to wander through a Home Depot or Lowe's or Walmart garden center, kind of anonymously look around. They're not going to be intimidated because they're intimidated by independent garden centers. We've heard this time and time again in focus groups that we've done. You have to have a good working knowledge of Latin to walk into a garden center. That's what a lot of people think. And so they are going to the big box stores. I'm glad big boxes are getting better. The companies like Bell Nursery and Metroline or Costa, these really big boys, are doing a better job in those garden centers where a customer can come in, buy something, and be successful. And then they might go, hey, I'm a real gardener. Maybe I can go now to an independent. Anybody else? Anybody else?
Question hog.
He's like me. He's got a million of them.
I've noticed on the care tags have gone from being printed so much to having these little scanned items on. What's that all about?
Oh, QR tags or MS tag. That technology is coming out of Japan. You go to Japan, everywhere you turn, you see these little black QR tags. And so we've been experimenting with them in our industry. I don't know how well they're going to work. The challenge, I think, is the technology. I have a QR reader on my phone, and if I'm standing in a bright, sunny garden center looking at this plant beside me and I want to buy it, do I really want to go, call up the QR reader, get it loaded up, snap the thing, get it snapped? Now I'm in a sunny garden center and I'm trying to read all about it on this little tiny screen or watch a video or something. I can't see it. It's too much work. Whereas I was in Kohl's, and actually I'm seeing this in a lot more stores now, where there are little, basically like, sort of mini iPad size screens hanging right on the end of the shelf, playing little videos or showing the prices. They can, in the back room, they can change the prices immediately or whenever they want to. So I think instead of making the consumer do the work, at least when it comes to, say, plant tags or consumer products right in the store, I think you're going to see more little video screens or bigger screens or whatever playing that information right there. I've talked to tag people about even tags that have little video players built into them. Are we going to get to that point? You know, why have this? Have it hanging on the plant when they get cheap enough. So it's all an attempt to find more ways to get more information to consumers, but we haven't made it easy enough for consumers. So I don't know where that's going to go.
Chris, thank you.
All right. My pleasure.